This is True Crime Exposed, and I'm your host, Kayla Waters, joined this week by my co-host, Alicia Jenkins. This show was created to give victims a voice when they no longer have one. And by doing that, we're able to expose the monsters lurking all around us. Welcome back, everyone. If you have kids, I hope you all enjoyed spring break. I think those are wrapping up around this time that this is coming out, or they should be wrapping up soon. We did ours a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know about you guys, but I thrive way better in my schedule when we are on our consistent schedule. Like, my kids are going to school, everyone's doing their thing. I'm a lot better then, but I also enjoy a little break from time to time. We ended up going to Moab, Utah for spring break. It was great. We did some rock crawling and some side-by-side riding. So if you're into that, definitely 10 out of 10 recommend. It was a good time. But now it is time for me to come back to reality and talk to you guys about the mystery that is other people's minds. I probably say, I don't understand almost every episode of this podcast because I don't. I don't understand so much of what goes into these cases. I don't understand how people get there, how they commit horrific crimes like murder and rape. I can't wrap my mind around the victims who actually go through these tragedies in real life. And that is why I'm so intrigued by these cases. And I empathize so deeply in my gut. Like, truly, I feel for these people because it is so unfair that people go through these things. And today, we're talking about how people get their minds to a place where they are convinced to take their own lives. It's also something I can't understand. Today, we are talking about a cult. With that, are you ready for today's case? So I talked to you a little while ago and told you that we were going to be talking about the Heaven's Gate cult. Did you say you remembered it a little bit or no?
I don't remember.
Okay. Because it, like, happened around the time, like, you would have been, like, 20.
Okay. I think I've heard about it, but I don't remember the exact story.
Okay. So, it started in about 1975, and it came to an end in 1997. The group ran for over two decades, and this all starts because of Bonnie Lou Nettles, who was born in 1927. In the early 1970s, Bonnie was working as a nurse in Houston, Texas, and she was at the hospital. She loved everything that had to do with babies, so she was drawn to working with them. She had a daughter of her own that she named Terry, and they were thick as thieves. The duo spent lots of mother and daughter time together. Bonnie would take Terry to dance and acting classes, and during these drives to classes, Bonnie would often talk about everything to do with spiritualism. Bonnie had what people considered back then as New Age thinking. She loved the idea of psychic mediums and all things astrology. So she was interested in crystals and seances and had this deep love for nature. Bonnie was also intrigued by UFOs. And this was a new concept around this time in the 1970s, where people all over started to believe in alien sightings. And Bonnie would wonder to herself if a world beyond our own was possible. So while she's working as a nurse, a man named Marshall Herf Applewhite, who everyone called Herf, was admitted to the hospital after having a mental breakdown. Herf had been Herf. Yeah, like H-E-R-F-F.
Herf.
Yeah.
That's a weird name.
I know. When I've heard it all the times, like before this, I always thought it was Herb, but I guess it's Herf is what they called him.
Okay.
So Herf had been teaching a choir class at the University of Alabama in 1962. His students seemed to love him. He was laid back and charismatic, and he had this knack for performing musically. And there was one rumor about him, though, and that was that he may have been having an affair on his wife. And this affair was with a male graduate student. And this is something that Herf would have wanted to keep very secret, because not only was he married, but he grew up in the first Presbyterian church, and his father, also named Marshall Applewhite, was a strict reverend for the church. And I'm not sure if this rumor is part of the reason his wife divorces him, but she does leave, and Herf goes into a downward spiral. He quits his job at the University of Alabama, and he leaves to Houston, Texas. He went there to follow his dreams of making it big on the opera stage. And Herf did land a role he could be proud of, the biggest role he had ever been offered. And this was the role of Olin Blitch, who is a traveling preacher who seduces Susanna in the opera titled Susanna. It's during rehearsal practice that Herf falls into a psychotic episode and is taken to the hospital. Although he will later claim in teachings that he met Bonnie just while visiting a friend at the hospital. Regardless, they meet at that Texas hospital, and these two coming together would unfortunately change the course of many people's lives. The two of them hit it off because they had a lot in common. They both loved musical theater, with their most favorite being the musical Sound of Music. But when Bonnie and Herf meet, remember, he is in an extremely vulnerable position, as he just literally had a mental health crisis, a psychotic breakdown, and he was admitted to the hospital. So it's during this time that Bonnie convinces Herf that they are soulmates, and she talks about her spiritual beliefs, telling him that they were meant to be together. She does this by telling Herf that she is an astrologer and that she can read his birth chart. So from reading, she confirms to him that they are fated to work together on a big spiritual project. So after leaving the hospital, Herf goes to live with Bonnie, along with Bonnie's husband and daughter, because she is married.
Oh, I was thinking she was not.
I know, because she's telling Herf, like, you're my soulmate, we're supposed to do this big thing together. But she's married, and she still has Herf come to live with her husband and daughter. So Bonnie and Herf obviously are very close, but they have always claimed through their whole lives that they were never romantically involved, just that they were like very spiritually close. However, like, I personally am not sure how much I buy that, but
I wonder how long he was in the hospital for.
I know. I didn't see how long specifically, but he was at least there for a few days, if not a few weeks.
Well, yeah, if you someone's coming to move in with you.
You obviously
quite a while.
You obviously got close enough, yeah, to bring them to your home. So, yeah, I think he was there for a hot minute. And, you know, at this time, like I said, we're in the early 1970s. Bonnie, her husband, and her daughter, Terry, are living with Herf, and things are kind of awkward. Bonnie's husband is not loving the arrangement or his wife's new soulmate hanging around all the time. So this tension causes Bonnie and her husband to divorce, and once that split does happen, Bonnie decides that her and Herf must go off searching for their mission. She decides by doing this, she's going to leave Terry behind, although Terry is an adult now, about 19 or 20 years old. So it's a perfect time for Bonnie to go off, move away from her daughter and her ex-husband. And Bonnie explains to Terry that this is something she is supposed to do. but that once she discovered what that was, she would be back. Terry begged her mom not to leave, but Bonnie did, and although they would discover what they believed to be their mission, she did never come home. So, in 1972, Bonnie and Herf head out searching for what they were meant to do. They visit other New Age groups, and along the way, they take up little side jobs just to make money so that they can continue traveling, and they have to keep fixing their car up as they go because it keeps breaking down. So they just do, you know, little work here and there. And by July of 1973, they've been out and about for more than a year, and this is when they end up in Oregon. It's here that Bonnie and Herf have the confirmation of what their life mission is. They decide that they are the two witnesses who are foretold in the book of Revelation, and that they are destined to be martyred, and that they will rise from the dead. So, they decide they have a big role to take on.
Yeah.
And the documentary on HBO Max titled Heaven's Gate, The Cult of Cults, references the Bible verse Revelation chapter 11, verses 3 through 12. That says, quote, "And after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and they ascended up to heaven in a cloud." To Bonnie and Herf, this verse might have seemed to be talking about a cloud to those in the first and second century. But Bonnie and Herf said everyone just didn't understand it, and that this verse was actually referring to a flying saucer, a UFO that would come down from heaven to pick up its worthy members.
She sounds a little off her rocker, too.
Oh, yeah. So he had a mental breakdown, and I assume she's also not in the best mental health space either. Now, Bonnie and Herf start recruiting others to join them and their newfound belief. The news of this group goes public in 1975 when a news story breaks out about 20 missing people who seem to have disappeared from the Oregon coast. What happened was Herf and Bonnie were holding get-togethers and little classes to teach their beliefs and convince people to join their movement. They had a big impact on those they taught in Waldport, Oregon, and these people wanted to be a part of their group. In order to be a part of the group, members were required to cut ties with all their earthly connections. They were told to sell their possessions and cut off all contact with their families. So when a large group of people does this, leaving their families behind confused, the story breaks. Their families are out looking for them, talking to police and the media, and they find out that their loved ones joined what was looking an awful lot like a cult. Back then, in the 70s, cults were prevalent, and people were becoming worried about the consequences of them. The Manson murders done by the Manson family cult were committed in 1969. The Jonestown mass suicide by the followers of Jim Jones would occur in 1978, just a few years after this incident in Oregon. So you can see why the families of these people joining were definitely alarmed. This was a time where the dangers of cults were really showing up. So any group that requires you to cut contact with your families is a big red flag. So when Bonnie and Herf started spreading their message in Oregon, they were handing out flyers about UFOs that could take you to another world and life. Erica Ernest and Frank Lyford, who were originally from Calgary, Alberta in Canada, were traveling around the world together. They had been dating for 2 years and were madly in love. The couple had just gone on a 6-week trip through Europe in 1975, and then they made their way over to the Oregon coast. They were coming here to visit Frank's cousin, David Van Vinderen, and it's here that all three of them come across Bonnie and Herf's new group, and they are both enamored during their first meeting. Deeply drawn to the message, both Erica and Frank and his cousin David decide to sell everything they had and leave Oregon with the group. The flyer that Frank had originally come across, which prompted him to attend Bonnie and Herf's meeting, read, quote, "If you ever entertain the idea of a physical level above the human level, you want to attend this meeting." Susan Strom also joins the group in 1975 while attending Oregon State University. She left just barely before she would have graduated, and she was a big outdoors lady who had worked as a camp counselor during the summers and was an aspiring botanist. Susan's father was named Lyle Strom, and he was a senior U.S. district judge. Lyle and Susan's mom, Regina, missed their daughter dearly when she left, and although she was supposed to cut contact with them completely, they would receive very occasional letters and phone calls from their Susie. John Craig also joined the cult in 1975. John was married to his high school sweetheart, Mary Ann Craig, and the two of them had six kids, ages ranging from 8 to 18, and they had married in 1954. So by 1975, they had been married for about 21 years. John worked in a real estate development office, and they were living in Colorado at the time. In July of 1975, Mary loads all of her kids into the car and she heads off to an out-of-town swim meet for one of them. When the family returns, they find a note from John. He had left to join this group and he would not be back. I'm sure the family was completely devastated by his sudden abandonment, and they would never really get closure because John never returns. Bonnie,
that is crazy. How are all these people just leaving?
I know, like they have, these are people who have full-on families, full-on careers. Like a lot of people left behind kids and parents and, you know, they weren't all just like out without much family, like looking for something that they need, like were missing, you know?
Yeah.
They were just drawn to this message. It's sad.
Who was the spokesperson? Both of them? Herf and...
Yeah, so Bonnie's like the main leader, and then Herf is like her follower and also the other leader.
Oh my gosh, okay.
And Bonnie would teach things like, quote, "Now the part that hurts for you is the fact that all the ones you considered your family really is not your family." Herf went on to say, quote, Your family, don't forget, are those who are here doing the same thing as you, and those other members of the next level. They are your family. So you can kind of see here how they are pressuring them to cut contact with their family and telling them that their real family are the other people in this cult. It's like telltale signs of a cult.
Yeah.
So the next level, this is what Bonnie and Herf referred to as heaven. When you left Earth on the UFO, they would then take you to the next level, where you would shed your human body, which they called your earthly vehicle, and you would transform into an alien-like figure, which was your true form. Herf said, quote, "Can you shed humanness? When you shed that, hang on, because it will be growth after growth, and then it will change you into this being." He also taught, quote, "It's common for a person going through an awakening for his life to begin to fall apart."
So they told people that they were going to leave on a UFO?
Yes. So the whole concept is that this UFO would come and pick them up. Originally, the concept is while they're alive, and then take them to what is heaven, which they called the next level.
Okay.
And it's there that they could shed their earthly vehicle, their body, and become their true self, which is an alien.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was taught that your body would have this chemical and biological transformation into the perfect space creature. And like I said, you would physically board a UFO. Herf taught, quote, "When a human has overcome all of his human level activities, a chemical change takes place and he goes through the metamorphosis just exactly as a caterpillar does when he quits being a caterpillar. And he goes off into chrysalis," I'm probably not saying that right, "and he becomes a butterfly. Once you overcome this planet, you are airborne. You are free, and we will show you how to make it to the next level."
How did people believe this stuff?
This, like, the 1970s was a huge time for UFOs, like, and alien sightings. So I think it just, like, really drew people in because it was so popular and, like, getting so big. The idea in general. So, from Waldport, Oregon, the group would camp together or camp in smaller groups, and they were very secretive as they traveled across the country teaching and camping. Now, obviously, most people attending these meetings were already searching for something more. They're in some sort of spiritual dilemma, and they are looking for purpose. Many people at this time believed the world was also coming to an end, so, like, the people in the community. It not only was a big time for UFOs, but it was a big time for, like, world-ending times, you know?
Yeah.
So, Herf taught during his classes, quote, "Planet Earth is about to be recycled. Your only chance is to leave with us." And another thing that could have played into this, on top of it being the first time the community is starting to believe in aliens, is that one of the best-selling books during these years was titled Chariot of the Gods. And this book claimed there was evidence that the world's ancient religions were actually founded by extraterrestrial visitors. So all this new talk about aliens and UFOs and the end of the world really made it easy for people to accept Bonnie and Herf's message. And as this new religious group formed, Bonnie and Herf had everyone refer to them as the Two. But their names would evolve over time. Next, they wanted to be called Bo and Peep because they were the ones leading the sheep. And finally, they settle on the names they would be known as, like, in history. And these names came from their favorite musical, of course, The Sound of Music. They would be called T and Doe. Bonnie was T and Herf was Doe. So a lot of the quotes from people will, like, refer to T and Doe. So again, Bonnie is T, Herf is Doe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
I just don't like theories, conspiracy theories like that, that scare people.
Well, this isn't even really a conspiracy theory. It's a religion that they're teaching.
Well, yeah, but it's like, oh, the earth is going to end. Earth is going to blow up or whatever, you know. I know.
I don't like end of the world talk at all. I'm like, if anyone tries to talk to me about the end of the world, I'm like, don't talk to me about it. I'm going to live in my ignorance until that comes. I just want to live my life, worry about my kids, and keep on going.
Exactly.
So when that whole disappearance of 20 people from Waldport, Oregon made the news, it caught the attention of a sociology professor by the name of Robert Balt. So he sort of kept an eye on the news involving this group. So when he travels to Arizona for a research project, a poster on the wall of a building stands out to him. This poster reads, quote, "Humans, do you really know what Christ came to tell us? Do you believe in flying saucers? Are you ready to take your body to the next kingdom?" Immediately, Robert thinks that this might have been hung by the group that went through Waldport, Oregon. he was intrigued enough that he attends a meeting there in Arizona. And Robert remembers that the two, Herf and Bonnie, were not in attendance. Instead, members of their group presented the message. And following that class, 9 people decided to join. Robert found this whole thing so bizarre that he decides to go undercover and join the group just to gain insider information. So Robert calls a fellow sociologist named David Taylor and asks if he wants to join this mission. Robert described David as a hippie-type graduate student, and he was the only friend Robert thought might come along for the ride. So the members in that class had explained that they were going on a trip to reunite with their 2 leaders. Robert expresses his interest in joining, and they tell him to go to the town of Verinda, which is just outside of Oakland, California, and to find the post office. It's there that they would leave him an address in page 100 of the zip code book. So as you can tell, the group is pretty secretive about where they would be and where they were traveling. They were sort of always on the run to keep their family members from tracking them down. So Robert and David do find the zip code book, but there is no address. Instead, the group leaves a message to meet them at the top of Mount Diablo. The duo has to hike to this location, and when they arrive, the area is empty. However, inside the garbage bins are things related to the group's literature. So before Robert is disappointed, but then 2 cars pull up, and it is the Heaven's Gate group. Robert and David hop into the car, and off they go. They keep record of everything they learn, but they have to be discreet about their notes so that they don't get caught. The group seem to teach self-focus and not focus on anyone else's progress. They called the transition from your human body to your alien body the, quote, human individual metamorphosis. Members of the group traveled often, living a nomadic lifestyle. But one member also described it as social chaos, the blind leading the blind. At first, they were normally camping everywhere they went, using donations to live on from going door to door, spreading their message. So it was pretty easy for Robert and David to keep their head down and not draw suspicion to them, basically spying on the group, because they were not supposed to make human connections. So they just kept to themselves. They were the only people who had gotten behind the scenes with this group. So after about 3 months, they decided to write some academic papers and they would be featured as the cover story for Psychology Today. The duo concludes in these papers that this group was unique, but that they didn't seem to feel the leaders asserted any authority. They found no evidence of manipulation, coercion, or brainwashing. To them, at that moment, it felt like there was free choice. However, this was 20 years before the tragedy of Heaven's Gate. And Robert admits in the documentary that his mind back then couldn't grasp the gravity of what was going on. So, like, hindsight's 20/20. Looking back, he can see that there was manipulation and coercion, but in very subtle ways.
Yeah.
And
there has to be in some way.
Right. And I don't blame them for seeing that the leaders were kind and charismatic and seemed to want what was best for their members, because that's exactly how the leaders wanted to be seen. The danger of it all is hidden between the lines of the message. As nice as someone seems to be saying something, it's scary to be taught things like cutting off contact with your family or selling all of your possessions and going on the run, traveling from place to place as to not get caught. Other things in the group were also banned, such as music, any sexual thoughts or actions alone or with others.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah, like, they cannot have any sexual thoughts, even in their own private, like in their own private life, completely by themselves.
Yeah, I feel like most of the cults have sexual
I know there is actually a sexual element to a lot of cults. You're right.
Yeah.
Like in the Manson family, there was a weird sexual element. But yeah, in this one, it's the opposite. They like would make them feel very guilty even for having a wet dream, which is not in your control. It's like when it must be released because it has been there too long, you know? Yeah. So eventually, another odd thing is that the group also had to adopt the same look. They would all have the same haircut. A short boy-style cut that would be given to all the members, including the women. Cults need you to conform. They need to break you down and create a new you. So meetings were held twice a day to tune into the next level. They would do this with what they called a tuning fork, which was a note A 440 hertz. And they were taught that their mind should be tuned to this frequency specifically. So the members would use this tuning fork. They would hit it so it made the sound and then stick it to their head while humming to themselves. One member was recorded saying, quote, "It's difficult for our friends and family who really love us to understand that we really want to do this." And this was true. Family members grieved the loss of their loved ones because all communication was cut off. Those following Heaven's Gate had to rid themselves of all their worldly connection, even their own children.
Ugh, I just do not like that.
I don't either. Like, nothing should teach you that you should put them before your children.
Right.
So, Herf, aka Doe, taught, quote, "If an individual finds themselves with children and they know that it is time for them to move up into the kingdom of God, they must weigh where their responsibility is, to their heavenly father or to their children." Which I'm like, your responsibility is to your children on this earth if you are taking care of them. So, yeah. And I'm pretty sure anybody's God out there that is real would want you to take care of your children.
Yeah.
I just don't see a God that wouldn't want that.
It's so hard for me to like wrap my brain around like these type of teachings and thinking. Like, yeah. Even, remember I was telling you about that show, The Secrets of Polygamy?
Right.
Like, it's hard for me to even think, like, how some of those people, and some of them are educated, like, on one of the episodes, one of them's like a nurse practitioner, I think. And it's like how, yeah. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around how they can believe in certain beliefs. I don't know.
I know. I think it's hard to like wrap your mind around anything that like just does not seem logical to you. But
yeah, because it's like, oh, yeah, well, you have this family, but we're going to take your wife away and your children and she's going to marry this guy. Like, why would you stay?
I know. It really is coercion. Just even if they don't see it while they're going through it.
And, like, why would any church or whatever, what religion, like, why would they do that?
I know. It's a dangerous teaching if you're ever taught to choose anything over your children or your spouse and that the best thing to do is abandon them. Like, you're definitely being led wrong.
It's just hard to wrap your brain around something that would teach right. That.
Yeah, they're not, they don't have your best interest in mind.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, a couple, Suzanne and Wayne Cook, fell into this trap. Their daughter is Kelly Cook, and she was interviewed in the documentary and said that both of her parents were smart, but they were not simple in the way they thought about anything. Wayne was an inventor, and they both had big ideas and big dreams. So they attended a meeting in late August of 1975, and the message resonated with the couple. Suzanne thought it was exactly what she had been looking for. Kelly was 10 years old when her parents sat her down and told her that they would be leaving with a group they were drawn to. They explained the concept and how once they went off with the group, their bodies would be taken to the next level, and that could be as soon as a month or two away. And once that happened, they would never see Kelly again. So they tell this to their 10-year-old daughter, like, we're leaving.
Oh,
our bodies are going to a new world and we'll never see you.
How? That, how can you even tell that to one of your kids?
I know. Like, that would be devastating for a 10-year-old girl to hear.
Yes. And I sometimes wonder, do these people that join these, like, are, do they have mental issues?
No. Like, I mean, I think anyone can have mental issues, but a lot of these people are just, like, regular people.
That they thought, but I mean, like, who is regular when you're like, tell your 10-year-old, I'm leaving.
I know.
My body's going to be translated to an alien. Like, I don't feel like you're like a normal person.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not okay at all. So, and Kelly said herself that she begged her parents not to leave. She told them as a 10-year-old that it is ridiculous to believe that a UFO was coming to get them. She said that at that young age, she could see right through it all.
Yeah.
But obviously. Her parents, yeah. Her parents were too convinced, though. So they moved Kelly into Suzanne's parents' home, and then they left with the Heaven's Gate cult, telling Kelly that they would not be allowed to contact her again. She felt really helpless. I know. And at 10 years old, she said she knew she couldn't compete with God. And that's who her parents believed they were following. She explains that this made her feel meaningless. And this is awful. Like, I truly don't understand how you get to the point that you leave your children behind. And there will never be anything that is the truth that encourages you to abandon your little babies. Because at 10, they're still your baby. Like, you cannot leave them.
Oh, yeah. I wonder what their parents were thinking.
I know. I'm sure her parents were also shocked and also probably mortified because not only are they leaving their daughter, but now she cannot contact them anymore either.
So bizarre.
Yeah, it really is. So between 1975 and 1976, the media grabs onto the story of the Heaven's Gate cult and they run with it, calling the group the UFO cult. Reporters are able to discover that the leaders, referred to as T and Doe, were actually Bonnie Lou Nettles and Marshall Herf Applewhite. Following the media frenzy, the cult shrinks by about 50%. Bonnie and Herf teach that they have basically been resurrected and compare themselves to Jesus in the Bible. Their resurrection wasn't a physical death. Instead, the media killed them and they rose from the ashes. Herf teaches, quote, "Our prayer for your sake is you will start warding off all the bombardment that you will begin to hear. They say, boy, is this guy crazy? Is this a cult if I have ever heard one? Yes, it is. It's a cult. I mean, it's the cult of cults. It's the cult of truth." So,
okay.
He's like, they're getting all this bad media. And of course, he has to come out and say, like, oh, I hope you won't listen to that. Like, don't listen. They're going to say I'm crazy, but I'm not. Like, they're saying we're a cult. Yeah, we are. It's the cult of truth. And I think that's where the HBO, like, title, the documentary on it, title comes from, because it's, you know, Heaven's Gate, the cult of cults. And that comes from this quote from him.
Oh, yeah.
So, and a lot, these quotes, I'm taking them directly from video they created of their teachings. So if you watch that documentary, there's a video of the cult, like in their classes. There's a lot of video that's actually really, really intriguing.
Okay.
So Bonnie and Herf, they write a book titled How and When Heaven's Gate, The Door to the Physical Kingdom Level Above Human May Be Entered. Another publication of theirs was called Ruffles, Snacks for Thinkers. And the book was titled this way because they believed a UFO sort of looked like a potato chip. So it was a play on words. They also distribute a book of rules and regulations around this time. Things were asked in this book like, do you participate in inconsiderate conversation? Do you put tasks off and procrastinate? Do you follow instructions? Because the group was strict, down to the way that pancakes were made. You had to follow instructions on a very specific size and shape. Check partners were also assigned to each person. So those in the group were paired up, and you would basically keep an eye on each other to make sure you were following these regulations. Former member Leslie Light explained that you were typically paired up with the person you least liked in the group. So it would like push you, I think, because the person you least liked would tattle on you a little easier.
Yeah.
And you guys wouldn't get close and be like, hey, don't tell them that I'm doing this or something.
Yeah.
So the major offenses would be things like lying to T and Doe, not following instructions, and sexuality in thought and nature. So couples that came into the group, such as a couple we have talked about, like Erica Ernest and Frank Lyford, or Suzanne and Wayne Cook, they had to give up their intimate relationship in order to be a part of the group and move up to the next level. By 1978, the group is recording their teachings. T, aka Bonnie, taught, quote, "The point I want to stress is that you are all in a classroom 24 hours a day. Everything that happens to you is a test on how you act in situations, not as human, as next level, striving for perfection." And the group started using different names for items that would relate to space. So a house was called the craft, the kitchen was the Nutri-Lab, the laundry was the fiber lab, the mind was referred to as the computer, and their human beliefs were their programming. So they started treating everything as if it was like alien. Like Nutri-Lab, that was kind of funny to me. Like nutrition lab, Nutri-Lab. It's so like for the kitchen. Wow. I'm like, all right, good one.
Oh my gosh.
So as this kind of happens, Doe starts talking about how nuns took different names to disassociate themselves from their family tree, and now he wants the group to do the same. So it's said in the documentary that they basically start living like monks. They're abstinent, they take new names, and they're totally cut off from the outside world. The group would all share the last name Odie. So this is how all their names would end. The beginning of their name was always three consonants. So a man named Rob had his name changed to Robody, spelled R-B-B-O-D-Y. They would joke that they were the family of Odd, since it's Odie, O-D, since everyone thought that they were a bit weird. So they're like, we're the family of Odd. Everyone thinks we're freaks.
Yeah.
Like, they embraced it because they really didn't feel that they were weird. They really felt that, like, they were the ones who knew the truth. Like, they knew how to get to heaven. Okay. So I'll say some more names so that you get an even better idea. So Margaret Richer was known as Melody. Gordon Welch was known as Stamody. David Sundred was Allody. David Moore was Alxody. Rio was Neody. Dick Jocelyn was Dinkody. Dana Tracy Abred was Yinvody. Chuck Humphrey was Rakoti, and Sawyer was Sweoty.
What?
I know the names will get you.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I don't want to make fun of them, but the names are they're kind of funny. Because it's like they're all Odie. So like that is what they really became known as. Like these names. All ending in Odie.
So you'd be K-O-D-E?
Yeah, I'd be like, let's see, it's consonant. So it'd be like, probably like K-Y-L-O-D-E, Kilodie.
Kilodie.
You'd be A-L-Y, Aliodie.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wait, it's no, just, so they don't use vowels?
They use L's.
Vowels.
Oh, yeah. They don't use vowels in their names. It's three consonants and then O-D-Y.
Oh, so my A wouldn't count.
Except they have A's in there.
Or a Y.
Because David Moore was A-L-X. So I don't know. They said it was three consonants, but I don't think they got it right every time. So, and like Rio was Neody, and that's N-E-O. So...
Neody?
I don't know. They used vowels, I guess, but they said that it would be three consonants and then O-D-Y. Anyway, okay. You get the point. So
yes, it's weird.
Around this time, the group also starts wearing uniforms that matched. They had matching haircuts, no makeup was allowed, and they all wore tennis shoes. But somehow, regardless of all these rules, the members believed they were not living in an oppressive system. One former member said it was a fun time in his life, and that's when he had the most growth. Doe would teach that the rules do not restrict them, that instead it frees them. Again, the group would refer to their human bodies as their vehicles. Margaret Richer, a member of the group, explained in a recorded video that those in the group understood they broke the hearts of their family members, but that the vehicles, aka their bodies, that used to care for their family were the greatest threat to themselves. Families were constantly searching for their loved ones in the group, so T and Doe start becoming pretty paranoid about being followed or found. By 1978, they stop camping and start renting mansions. They would designate a certain group of people allowed outside the home so that the neighbors wouldn't know how many people were actually living inside. And parents were sending letters to the FBI in search of their children. But the response was that these were consenting adults who chose to go off with this group, so nothing could be done. But David Moore, a.k.a. Axolotti, had a mom who would not give up. And this was Nancy Brown.
How did it become Axolotti?
I don't know. Truly, I don't. But he's known as Axolotti. Oh, so, David Moore's mom, she says that David joined when he was 19 years old in 1975. And David had told his mom that he couldn't imagine living the kind of life that most people do. The next 5 years were excruciating for her. Different parents had tried to hire private investigators, but no one had luck locating their children. By 1980, Nancy had fully formed a parents' group. Nancy sent out...
So why didn't they want anyone to know where they were?
Like, because they're not allowed to contact their family, so they didn't want their family reaching out to them and keep trying to find them and call the police to try and get them.
Oh.
So Nancy...
Like, just tell them not to talk to them.
They tried, but, you know, like, as parents, you just wouldn't give up trying to get your kid back.
Yeah.
And I'm sure T and Doe didn't want, like, the parental pressure and the family pressure finally getting to the members so they would keep them on the run.
Red flag.
So, Nan... Yeah. So Nancy sent out weekly or monthly letters with updates on any information they could find. And these letters would go to parents whose children had also run off with the Heaven's Gate group. It was in 1979 that Nancy had felt completely gutted by the Jonestown news. This was the cult that committed mass suicide by drinking poison after they left the United States for Jonestown, following their leader, Jim Jones. Nancy felt in her gut that whatever her son was a part of was not good news, and that's what encouraged her to start this parents group, which she called the Family Network. Bonnie, aka T, addresses Nancy's search for her son and other people's children by telling the class that she doesn't know why their parents are making such a fuss, because it's not unusual for sons and daughters to leave homes and do what they want. And while that's true, it is unusual for people to leave the home and just cut off contact with no reason.
Yeah.
Now, while all the members are cutting off their family and world possessions, Bonnie is keeping in touch with her daughter, Terry Nettles. Terry would hear from her mom once a month via letters, and they would also talk on the phone. But when they did that, Bonnie would say that Herf was on the other line. So, in one letter, Bonnie urges Terry not to tell anyone who the letters are from, especially the Family Network woman, David Moore's mom, Nancy Brown. So, Bonnie didn't want people knowing that she was breaking her own rules and speaking to her daughter, while she taught her followers that they should not be talking to theirs.
Of course.
Right. And obviously, if Herf was on the other line, he also knew that Bonnie was talking to her kid.
Yeah.
Now, also keep in mind that this entire time, Bonnie and Herf, aka T and Doe, have taught that in order to achieve the next level, they would take their physical bodies up and be transformed. It was never taught that the next level could be achieved after human death. That was where this sense of urgency came in. They had to join now, and they had to be the best they could be now before it was too late. Dick Jocelyn, a man who joined in Los Angeles, had wanted to be an actor, but joined the group as one of the first followers. During an early meeting that was recorded, he reiterates the teachings of the group, explaining that it is important to understand you cannot die and achieve the next level. You cannot die and get to heaven. The level is obtained only while you're alive and physically healthy. So, these teachings were a problem when Bonnie finds out she has cancer of the eye. Her eye is removed and she has to have a prosthetic put in. She kept it very quiet, although she spoke of it a little to the group. And soon after this scare, she learns that her cancer has metastasized to her liver. She was told that she didn't have much time, and only weeks later, Bonnie passes away. She never told her daughter Terry that she had cancer, and when she passed, the group was heartbroken, especially Herf. The idea was that they were all supposed to graduate to this next level together. It was Dick Jocelyn who called Terry to tell her that her mom had died, but this call didn't come until 9 months after Bonnie's death.
Oh.
Terry had wondered all those months, like, why did my mom stop writing me letters? And it's because Bonnie was dead. She had died in Texas on June 19th, 1985, and Terry was not informed until March of 1986. Apparently, Bonnie had asked the group not to tell Terry about her death. So, they didn't. And then when Terry finds out the information, she tries to get in touch with Herf, but she can't. Eventually, he does mail her an audio cassette where he recorded a message. He says, quote, "Terry, this is Doe. I'm a bit embarrassed and awkward about the fact that I didn't contact you when T left her vehicle or died, or however you want to look at it." He goes on to say he was torn trying to comply with T's wishes. He said he might have chickened out and couldn't talk to Terry. Doe said not to grieve because that's not what Bonnie wanted for Terry, and to know that it was not because of lack of love. He was praying for her release from her suffering and that his suffering has been great as well. He says that he loves her and wishes he could do more for her. And for a while, Herf, aka Doe, wasn't sure if he should continue what they referred to as his classroom teachings. He spiraled into grief. So in 1985, after Bonnie dies, he allows all the members to return to their homes for a short period to visit their families. And it's like he had perspective for a minute. Like, wow, it is actually important that people connect to their families before they don't have them anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird because it goes against all of his teachings before this and also against everything he will lead them to do after. So Erica Ernest and Frank Lyford, they were traveling home to Canada together. And on one of their layovers, Frank just had this overwhelming feeling to hug her. So he asked her if it was okay. And she said yes. And they embraced for the first time in 10 years since they had joined the group. Frank said that Erica was the love of his life and that he wanted to run away together. And if she would have told him, let's stop doing this, let's go do something else, then he would have said yes right then. But she didn't. She wanted to return after their trip home. And because Frank loved her, he agreed. David Moore also visited his mom, Nancy Brown, the woman who had started the family network. And she was overwhelmed with joy and gratitude. He was home for a couple of days, and she couldn't stop talking to him and hugging him. It was just a relief to know he was alive, because the parents truly didn't know if their kids were alive or dead, since they hadn't been heard from in over a decade. Which is so crazy to think about, just like going a decade and having no idea where your kid went, and just hoping they're out there okay.
That would be so hard.
It would be. So, all the members go home, but only one member stays with their families after they were supposed to return. And the rest of them all come back. Wow. Now, following 1985, there is a big shift in their belief. It has to change because they can no longer believe that going to the next level is a bodily transition because their leader, Bonnie, or T, has passed away. Now the belief is that the transformation to the next level must be a spiritual one. T had always been looked to as the older member in the group. Remember, it was her that recruited Herf to follow her. Bonnie had always been more new-aged with her thinking. Remember, she loved crystals and psychics and groups that looked into spirituality in a different way. And this differed from her experience growing up as a Baptist. However, Herf was always against New Age thinking until he had met Bonnie. So after her death, the belief system in the group starts to change because Herf's teachings revert back to being much more biblical in thinking. After Bonnie dies, Herf calls everyone together for a test. He asks if they had $100, what would they spend it on? And no one could come up with an answer because they were taught to give up all worldly possessions and they couldn't imagine spending their money on anything. So it turns out that the answer was a gold band because all of the members were set to marry Herf. He taught that God said, if you want to come to heaven, you need to love only me. So now they would all wear a wedding ring. A ceremony was held where all the men and women married Herf, or as they called him, Doe. And each member went up to him during the ceremony. He kissed them on the forehead and he was bawling his eyes out. And the loyalty in the group really starts to shift from the message to the messenger. They're viewing Herf as sort of a god. And during the documentary, former member Frank Lyford had trouble speaking the entire time. It seemed like he couldn't catch his breath. but it turns out that he had trouble speaking ever since Herf called him out during a classroom meeting. Frank had spoke during this meeting and Herf mocked how deep his voice is. Herf did this because they were supposed to be moving into a world that was genderless. So Herf was reminding Frank not to identify as being overly male. Frank was so humiliated that he gradually stops talking, which turned into almost an inability to speak. And by 1993, after 18 years in the group, Frank Lyford writes a note to Herf telling him that he needs to leave the group. Herf tells Frank that he is throwing away his opportunity to go to the next level, but Frank could just feel it in his gut that he needed to go. Once he is home in Calgary, Canada, his former girlfriend that he joined the group with calls. This is Erica Ernest, and she's known in the group as Chakotay. She was crying and begging Frank to come back, but Frank refuses, telling her that he thinks it would actually be good for her to spend some time outside of the group and gain some perspective on life on the outside. Erica didn't say anything, and this was the last time that Frank and Erica would ever speak. Now, remember, Herf was attracted to men, although they were not supposed to have any sexual thoughts in this group. So it was shocking to Dick Jocelyn when he was working as Herf's assistant, and Herf tells him that his vehicle, his body, is becoming attracted to Dick's vehicle. It's suspected. Yeah. So it's suspected that Herf was so ashamed of himself due to his deep religious upbringing that this is one of the reasons he so, like, in such a big way, tried to disassociate from his body. And then, you know, like, with things like giving their bodies names like the vehicle and acting like it wasn't really a part of who they were. They think it was kind of an internal struggle in him because he was gay, which was totally fine, and he should have just been himself. But because of his upbringing, he, like, couldn't get there. And so he had this, like, self-hatred that kind of he projected onto the group and, like, taught all these things about disassociating from your body.
Yeah. That
so
kind of makes sense.
Right. So this view of himself led to the thought of castration. Herf asks the other male members of the group if they would have reservations about undergoing castration. This is basically having your testicles removed. And obviously, as a result, you will never be able to have children again, and also many other things. So following a castration on a grown man, the sex organs will shrink and stop functioning, which will result in the ending of sperm formation and curb their sexual interest. It can also have even more negative side effects, such as depression, obesity, hot flashes, and more. So former member Sawyer remembers feeling extreme guilt over having wet dreams, which is where your sperm releases during your sleep after it has been built up for too long. This is pretty much out of your control, but members had to sign out towels when they needed to clean themselves so that everyone knew they had a wet dream. And Sawyer said this resulted in a very shameful feeling. So when the members were asked about castration, without hesitation, many of them agreed. They did a coin toss to determine who would be castrated first, and it was Stephen McCarter, known as in the group as Sorority. Herf performed the castration himself, and the area, his ball sack, started immediately swelling to a gigantic size, as you would think when your testicle is cut out of it, and Herf gets really nervous. Because you should not cut people's nuts out of their bodies by yourself at home.
No, nope, like, that's not a good you idea. You should.
Yeah. Like, Herf, what are you doing? So he panics and he's like, oh my gosh, I just did a terrible thing. Like, I went way too far. You have to call the police. But the members, again, they look to him as a god. So they're like, absolutely not. And nobody wanted to take Steven to the hospital because they knew authorities would look at her like, what's going on? Eventually, though, Steven is in way too rough of shape to ignore. And they do bring him to the hospital where he stays overnight. A few members take the testicles to the pier and throw them into the water to get rid of the evidence.
So he got both of them cut out?
I don't know if he, I'm assuming he got both taken out.
Okay.
Yes. And then it's after this at-home procedure's done that, like, his balls start actually swelling of shrinking.
Did he numb them?
I have no idea. Probably not.
Okay. How could you be that crazy to let somebody do that?
And this is another telltale sign of a cult. Doing, like, remember that awful cult we talked about where that guy did, like, horrible things, like cut a finger off, cut an arm off?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you cannot, no, never agree to an at-home procedure, ever. Big red flag here. So, you know, after this, they're like, ooh, we're not doing this at home anymore, thankfully. But they do find a doctor who was willing to perform the castrations. Oh. So around 9 of them were castrated by this doctor, including Herf.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Sawyer, who's a former member, he did not end up being castrated by the doctor, but 9 of them were.
Wow.
Wayne Cook, this is Kelly's mom, one of the Wayne and Suzanne, who had left their daughter Kelly behind when she was 10.
Uh-huh.
He was known in the group as Justody, and he was turned off by this whole castration thing. He's like, yeah, this is too much. So he leaves, and his wife, Suzanne Cook, does follow. She was known in the group as Slavody, and, you know, they leave and they go home. During their time in the group between 1975 and 1997, Wayne and Suzanne left and came back to the group 3 separate times, but they were always drawn back. So they left, but then they'd come back.
Oh.
Yeah. So by 1991, the group had dwindled to less than 50 members. They tried to find new members through the media and the internet as it started to become a thing in the 90s, but the internet ate the group alive. People mocked them and made fun of them. Sadly, it's not hard to see why those on the internet were cruel to the group. I mean, internet bullying is never okay, but as we know today, they are out there and they will come for you. So this group, it's not shocking to me that people came for them, but Herf had gone onto forums and commented things about himself being Jesus and that he was an alien going to the next level. And those on the internet thought it was nonsense.
Yeah.
Then the group even paid for a $30,000 ad in USA Today on May 27th, 1993. And this was to reach out to new members or connect with old members. They urged that the world was soon coming to an end and that now is the time to join and go to the next level. But none of their efforts resulted in many new members.
How did they even have 30,000?
I think because, like, a lot of them would do, like, a little bit of work. They would live off people, like, some of their trust funds. Like, there's so many of them. I think they all just pitched in money.
So
people outside of the group were starting to compare them to the Jim Jones group that I mentioned earlier, the Jonestown cult. So it was just people weren't really accepting their message. Jimmy Simpson, who was known as Gabody, joined in 1993. And his sister said that he had attempted suicide before the cult, and then he saw the USA Today ad, making comments about the earth about to be recycled. And he was looking for a place to belong, so he joined. Gail Mader, Yersodi joined in 1994. Her parents were Alice and Robert, and she said she had just broken up with her boyfriend of 4 or 5 years. She was going through it, and it was around this time that she sees a flyer for this group. Months later, she would leave this flyer behind for her parents and then tell them on the phone that she's leaving, she found what she's going to be doing, and she's probably never coming home. They said that she was with a group like monks and that she left the flyer for them to know what she was doing. They thought someday she would realize that this is not for her and that she would leave. A former member, Chuck Humphrey, was known in the group as Rakoti, and he had previously owned one of the first computer shops back in the 70s. So some of the group were able to use their computer skills. They created a business for the group called Higher Source. This is where they created like websites and sold graphic design skills. And this was one of the ways they would make money in order to continue putting their message out into the world. But with the continued rejection of their message on the internet, members started to believe that they wouldn't reach many more people and that instead it was time for them to leave this world. They also believed at this time that there was a war going on between the government and any people that believed differently than the norm. When Waco happened in 1993, this confirmed their belief that the government and community was out to get them. Waco was a government raid on a compound in Axtell, Texas, which led to a 51-day standoff between federal agents and members of a group called Branch Davidians. Their leader, David Koresh, died alongside 75 other Branch Davidians, 25 of whom were children. 4 agents on the government side were killed. So the Heaven's Gate group starts to believe that it is time for their exit from this world. In September of 1994, Herf asks the remaining members if any of them were against suicide in order to go to the next level. He explained that they would take a barbiturate to put their vehicles to sleep, and that at this time it was just a question. Herf said he was just wondering. He wasn't sure that this would be the plan. Many members fell to tears at this thought, while others were okay with it, as they had always planned to leave their earthly bodies behind and transform into aliens. Sawyer was one of the members who was okay with the thought of suicide in order to make it to the next level. However, he ends up leaving the group after struggling to stop masturbating. He tried to quit, but the urge was too extreme, and he felt so guilty about it that he didn't feel good enough, and he just wanted to leave. Herf was supportive of Sawyer's decision, so he bought him a plane ticket and gave him $600 to start over. And Sawyer is in that documentary I mentioned, and what's really sad is that he still to this day is consumed by this belief of the next level. Like, he didn't leave because of lack of belief, he left because he felt like, and this is a quote from himself, he felt like a pitiful person. And unfortunately, those feelings have stuck with him for all of his life. And he says he's still trying to be a better person in hopes that he will one day pass through Heaven's Gate birth canal and meet T and Doe and the other members on the other side.
Well, that's pretty sad.
So I know it is sad. Some of these people, even former members, are still stuck in it, or were still stuck in it after all of this. So in November of 1995, the Hale-Bopp comet passes the Earth, and it's the brightest comet to pass through the solar system since 1577. It was visible to the naked eye and was a huge event, and this brought on multiple predictions from all sorts of doomsday groups. Like, do you remember this? It was 1995, so I would have just been born. The Hale-Bopp comet, or I might be saying it wrong, Hale-Bopp comet. Yeah. So doomsday groups just took it and ran with it. And it's 1995, so the year 2000 was also creeping up on the world, which do you remember that being a time where a lot of people thought the world would end? Like the year 2000?
Yeah, Y2K.
Yeah. Yes. Like everyone was freaked out by like it changing into the new century. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are happening that are really playing into the teachings of tea and dough. The members of Heaven's Gate come to believe that the government was purposely hiding the fact that a UFO was trailing behind the Hale-Bopp comet. A picture of the comet comes out, and they claim it has a large object behind it. Multiple people call into radio stations claiming to have seen a UFO behind the comet. And Heaven's Gate believed this UFO was coming for them. It turns out the photo with a large object behind the comet was fake, and all the claims of seeing a large object behind the comet were completely false. The photo was fraud and just meant to stir up the idea of UFOs. So, you know, the Heaven's Gate, though, they don't want to hear that news. They still think there's a UFO behind the comet. So Herf decides that this is the sign that it is the group's time to exit this Earth. They want to leave when the comet is closest to Earth, and Herf coincides this with Easter. March 22nd, 1997 would be their exit. The mass suicide at the multi-million dollar mansion in Rancho Santa Fe where they lived aren't reported until March 26, 1997, when a 911 call comes in. This call comes from a man named Rio D'Angelo. He was a former member who was called Neody, and he had left only 2 weeks earlier, but still maintained a good relationship with the groups. He left because of this strange feeling he had in his gut. Weeks after leaving, Rio receives a package in the mail. It's from the Heaven's Gate group, and he is asked to go to the home and record what he finds. He does it, and the footage is shown on the documentary. The video is morbid. 21 women and 18 men, each laid in their own beds, flat on their back, wearing the same Nikes and black uniforms. All the members have this purplish, reddish blanket laid over their face and upper body to cover their death, except for two of them have a plastic bag around their head instead. Before they took their lives as a group, they traveled to Oregon to visit a spot where Bonnie and Herf had their first revelation. They also visit SeaWorld and San Diego's Wild Animal Park. And during this time, they start reaching out on their website, saying things like, last chance to advance beyond human. They were also paranoid that the government was after them and would take down their website. So they copied all their information onto floppy disks and then like just set them out around different cities. And then they start giving all their possessions away to former members. So they were preparing for this suicide well in advance.
Yeah.
And on March 20th, 2 days before the mass suicide, the group records what they called exit interviews. These VHS tapes were then sent to former members of the group. Erica Ernest, known as Chakotay, and this is Frank Lifehort's ex-girlfriend, said in her interview, quote, I just wish people could understand how it was instant recognition for me when I met T and Doe in Waldport 21 years ago, and there was never a doubt in my mind. I just wish people could understand how much we feel and know this is real. This is not fantasy. Lindley Averhart Pease, known as Demody, said, quote, I'll be happy just to get the suit of clothes off and put on a brand new fresh set with new vibrations and be in a new atmosphere. Julie Lamontagne, known as Lavodi, said, quote, we couldn't be happier about what we're about to do. Robert John Araso, known as Jamoti, said, quote, "I can hardly wait and I'm ready to go." Suzanne Cook, known as Silvoti, and who we've already talked about in this episode, this is Wayne Cook's wife and Kelly Cook's mom. They left the group when she was 10. Then they had been in and out. And by this time, Suzanne Cook had returned to the group while Wayne Cook had not. Suzanne said in her exit interview, quote, "I feel very honored and very, very lucky that I wasn't stuck back in the world where I chose to make the mistake of going for a little while." Kelly would later watch her mother's exit interview and states that she wished she could just reach through the screen, grab her mom, and tell her, like, do not do this.
Yeah.
But on the night of the exit, 39 members ate the same dinner and dessert. And then when police first arrive at the mansion days later to assess the scene, they thought that 39 men had taken their own lives because of the matching short haircuts. It wasn't until they went to the medical examiner that it was discovered to be 21 women and 18 men. Upon examination, the medical examiner determined that the deaths were peaceful, but they did not all die at the same time. Over a course of 3 days, they took their lives in 3 groups. The first group takes a combination of pills and alcohol, and once they have died, the second group cleans them up, covers them with those reddish-purple cloths, and then the second group proceeds with the plan. They take the pills and alcohol, they die, and the third group cleans them up. The third group is made up of only 2 people. They clean and cover that second group, and then it's those last 2 people who are found with the bags over their head instead of the cloth. Their deaths were labeled asphyxia with the assistance of pills and alcohol. In each of their pockets, they had $5.75. This was based on a Mark Twain story that stated the cost to ride the tail of the comet to heaven was $5.75. One sister of a former member said, quote, "Doe was so caught up in his own head, in his own narcissistic beliefs, and she knows the former members didn't feel that way, and she tries really hard to honor what they believe, but it's her own belief that they would still be with us if Doe had gotten the mental assistance he was needing." So, following this news, the media went wild with the story. They reported on these, quote, "crazy lunatics without their beliefs." But many former members didn't feel that the community was getting accurate information about the members. The former members don't feel like them or their classmates were idiots, or they didn't feel that they were duped. And sadly, like I said with Sawyer, many of the former members still believed in the message and were actually upset to not have gone on the journey with the others. Former members Frank Lyford and Sawyer did go on TV to defend their former group. And in the documentary, Frank does seem removed from the beliefs now, today. And he is devastated that the love of his life, Erica Ernest, took hers in the name of these beliefs. He didn't know who he was when he first left, but he says he finally feels free. He has purchased a van and he's going to travel and be on the road learning how to have fun again, which he hadn't allowed himself to do in a long time. However, like I said, Sawyer still follows the teachings of his leaders, T and Doe, and he hopes to be with them again one day. He claims that the people reporting on the suicide were not of mind to dig deeper, and Sawyer is stuck with the teachings he was taught. He says that he feels like he flunked his test and that he could have graduated, but that Doe did leave the door open for him and that there is nobody who can close it except himself. But he says when he decides to close the door, we won't be talking about this anymore. Meaning, like, at the time the documentary was made, it seems that Sawyer still longed to also leave Earth and go to heaven. He just hadn't yet.
Oh.
Which is sad.
It is.
You know,
really
it's like,
sad.
You don't have to feel that way. Like, just enjoy your time here. So, there were other members that felt the way Sawyer did. Jimmy Simpson was a former member that had left the group just before the mass suicide. He was known in the group as Gabote. And only 5 weeks after the tragedy, Jimmy's aunt receives a letter from him saying, "I should be dead by the time you get this." Heaven's Gate is also mentioned in this letter. And his aunt's husband rushes over to Jimmy's house. He gets there, he starts knocking on the door, and as he's doing that, he hears a gunshot inside. Jimmy had taken his own life in the name of Heaven's Gate. He left behind multiple pictures that he had cut out of magazines of his former class members, and underneath he wrote their cult names, their Odie names. He also left behind drawings of the 39 being lifted up to space. So even after the 39 people take their lives, there's like still a few more people that go through with the plan. Which is sad to think about, that they were like so stuck in like these teachings and conforming.
I know. And it was for so long, so many years, too.
Yeah. Like 20 years. They had already been like decades. Yeah. It's crazy. So Wayne Cook, this is the husband of Suzanne Cook, he struggled with the deaths when he learned of the news. He said he actually wished that he had the strength to remain with the group and had taken his own life. He longed to be with his wife. And Kelly, she could see her dad struggling. And, you know, she's older now because she was 10 when they left. So she's like almost 30 or already 30 by this point. And she pled with him to live his life out here on Earth, to live for her. She did not want to lose her mom and her dad. At this time, Wayne was living in Las Vegas with another former member, Chuck Humphrey. And the both of them felt like they were left behind by their group. So they make their own exit videos. In them, Chuck says that he will be gone by the time anyone sees this. Wayne says that he's happy and very much wants to follow his classmates and teachers, T and Doe. They go to a hotel to take their lives. And they're found in hotel room 222. Families are contacted, so Kelly gets a call that her dad has been one of two people found. These men had tried to commit suicide, but she's told that one of them is still alive. Unfortunately for Kelly, it was not her dad that survived. Wayne Cook had completed his mission. It was 57-year-old Chuck Humphrey, known in the group as Rakoti, who survived this suicide attempt. The duo had taken a combination of pills to overdose and then put the plastic bags over their heads to suffocate. Chuck had instinctively pulled off the plastic bag without realizing it. The drugs were not enough to kill him on their own. So Chuck was later interviewed on TV, and he explained that he wanted to join his class and former leaders. And when he was asked if he would ever try to take his life again, he said, "I don't know." And then a former member named Jason later receives an email from Chuck just a little less than a year after the mass suicide event. This email comes in February of 1998, and Chuck says that he's going to the spot and he will see Jason upstairs. Jason knew that the spot was a place the group used to camp. It was there that Chuck's body was found. He also completed his mission.
Oh my gosh.
So three people afterwards also take their lives. So, wow. Really like 42 people die from this.
Wow, that's so many.
Yeah, it's so sad to think they were like so drawn by this one man at this point that this is the right decision. So a few members that took their lives that day, the day of the exit, Jacqueline Leonard, she was 72 years old when she took her life with Heaven's Gate. She worked as a medical assistant and was married to a man named Charles who worked as an optometrist. They had three kids together, and her 94-year-old mother, Neva Garrity, lived with them as well. In the mid-70s, she had left her husband, kids, and mom to join the cult. The family had last seen her years before the suicide when she returned home in the company of seven other cult members. They all had dinner together, and then she left again. Jeffrey Howard Lewis was 41 years old when he took his life during the mass suicide. He worked as a male massage therapist and was born in Lubbock, Texas. Jeffrey served in the Navy before joining the cult. He ended up leaving for 12 years, and this was when he had worked as a massage therapist in San Antonio, Texas. His friend, David Taylor, begged him not to return to the group, pointing out that cutting off friends and family as a requirement is a red flag. But Jeffrey said he felt he lived a more meaningful life within the group, so he did return. Lucy Eva Peschow was 63 when she took her life alongside her classmates. She grew up in Pueblo, Colorado, and worked a paper route. She was a hardcore tomboy, and her sister Jean remembered Lucy telling everyone at school that her name was actually Tommy. She was also a shy kid, so when she moved to Los Angeles, she didn't have a lot of friends. She worked as a computer trainer for Packard Bell, and her brother Joseph remembers she joined in the late 70s because she found friends in the Heaven's Gate group. In 1989, Lucy made a call to her sister to let her know she was alive and happy. Joyce Scala was 58 when she took her life during the mass suicide. She was raised in Minnesota and then married a Navy officer and was charming. She won a beauty contest. And while she was living in Denver, she gave birth to twin daughters. And then the family moved and settled in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's there that she earns a journalism degree in 1975 and becomes a local TV personality. One day after coming across the Heaven's Gate teachings, Joyce completely changed and she leaves her husband and daughters behind to go with the group. Other members included Alfonso Foster, who was known as Ostody, Cheryl Butcher, known as Ann Lodi, Susan Paup, known as Nerodi, LaDonna Brugato, known as Glodoti, and Joyce Scala. Oh, I just talked about her. So we talked about more members in the beginning as well as throughout, and I will have a complete list in our show notes due to the amount of members there that took their lives and fell victim to the Heaven's Gate cult. After all the tragedy, former member Leanne Wolf contacts Robert, that sociologist who went undercover to study the group, and she says that she wants to host a Heaven's Gate reunion for former members. This is held 2 years after the suicides. So they all meet in Montana in 1998. Many ex-members come together. Some were still firm believers, and others were sure they had been duped or brainwashed. Lorraine Nelson attended, and she was still a true believer. She was sure that her classmates were at the next level. Lorraine's daughter, Sharon Nelson, was one of the first followers of the group, but she was not a believer anymore. She said that Herf, or Doe, had a Messiah complex. And then Dick Jocelyn, he was the one who Doe, or Herf, told that, like, my vehicle is becoming attracted to your vehicle. So he eventually leaves, and he works with a cult exit counselor named Steve Hassan. And he came to the conclusion that he had been brainwashed. Dick couldn't understand how the others didn't see that they had been led the wrong way. Unfortunately, he dies just a few years after the mass suicide from complications of AIDS in 2000. Terry Nettles had also attended that, you know, reunion. And this is Bonnie, aka T's daughter. And Terry wants to read excerpts from the letters her mom had sent her while in the group. So Bonnie had wrote her things like, be good, strive for goodness, and quote, conform to the ways of society so you will have peace of mind. And this was really odd because that was the opposite of the group's MO. Bonnie taught the group with Herf that they should not conform to society. So Terry, she felt like her mom maybe wanted out of the group and wanted to come home, but just couldn't face all of the questions and backlash if she did do that. And then she ended up dying. So as these excerpts were read, many former members at the reunion got angry because this did show a level of deception. Bonnie was writing her daughter while teaching them that they had to abandon their families, including their kids. And it made the whole thing feel like a con. But still, to this day, there are people like Sawyer who are stuck in that belief. Those who have been able to break free had their lives saved. Many families had grieved the loss of their children and loved ones for decades before the group took their lives. And they had worried for all those years as they weren't able to keep in touch. The families of these members had their worst fears come true. And that is the story of the Heaven's Gate cult. Thanks for listening. I research, write, host, and edit this show. My co-host is Alicia Jenkins. Our palette cleansers are given by Charlie Waters, and all our music was created by Jaden Schultz, who you can find on Instagram at InPajamasMusic. Please also find us on social media, on Instagram at TrueCrimeXPod, that's TrueCrime, E-X-P-O-D, and on TikTok at TrueCrimeExposedPodcast. We would also love it if you shared this episode on your own social media with your friends, your family, your coworkers. Spreading the word about our podcast is a huge deal to us, and we really appreciate it. You can also visit our show notes to find links to some of our favorite true crime apparel and some of our other favorite links, as well as all of our sources for this episode.